From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Florida has the third highest number of sex trafficking cases in the U.S., reported to the National Human Trafficking Resource Center. Victims of human trafficking are children, women, and men who are sexually exploited or coerced to work through force or fraud. As January marks Human Trafficking Awareness Month, today we go before a live studio audience to explore efforts here in Florida to better identify and treat victims of sex trafficking and to prosecute traffickers. We'll hear from victim advocates, state agency representatives, an assistant state attorney, an investigative reporter, and a sex trafficking survivor, among others. Addressing sex trafficking and changing the way we think about prostitution. First, this news. Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. For today's special edition of the program, we're joined by a live studio audience for a conversation addressing human sex trafficking. The National Human Trafficking Resource Center estimates more than 20 million people are enslaved worldwide, and that Florida ranks third in the nation when it comes to the number of reported sex trafficking cases. Victims of human trafficking are children, women, and men who are sexually exploited or coerced to work through force or fraud. It's hard to change what we think about prostitution, but a group of Floridians is trying to do just that. As January marks Human Trafficking Awareness Month, we'll explore changes in the way Florida's criminal justice system is handling prostitution as victims, not criminals, and going after pimps as traffickers instead. New state laws beginning in 2012 increased the penalties for sex trafficking, made it easier to convict those who traffic children, and directed resources to treat their victims. This year, adult entertainment venues, turnpike service plazas, highway rest areas, airports, train stations, and hospital emergency rooms are required to post signs urging people to be on the lookout for human trafficking. Another new law keeps the identity of sex trafficking victims confidential, and other new laws may come out of this year's state legislative session going on now. We'll hear one survivor's story and talk about efforts to eradicate human trafficking, especially here in Florida. We'll also be exploring ways to identify, protect, and prevent people, especially women and girls, in the U.S. from becoming victims. Today's special studio audience broadcast of Gulf Coast Live is being video streamed. Listeners can go online to watch the show at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Click on the Homegrown Girls link at the top of the page. And I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. Join us with our live studio audience and add your comments and questions by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And I wanted to begin the conversation by exploring exactly how domestic sex trafficking occurs here in the U.S. and maybe dispel some misconceptions people might have. One of our in-studio guests this afternoon is Jamie Walton. She co-founded the Wayne Foundation along with filmmaker Kevin Smith. That organization aims to spread awareness about sex trafficking around the country and to provide direct services to young women who've been victimized. Back when she was just a young teen, Jamie lived something of a double life. And I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Jamie. Tell us a little bit about your story and your background.
Well, when I was 14 years old, I was engaged in what I now know to be sex trafficking. At the time, I wasn't aware that's what was occurring. I was being transported from Florida to Atlanta every other weekend. And the person who trafficked me really presented this to me as he was my boyfriend. I came from a very abusive background in my home. My mother was abusive. My stepfather was abusive towards me. So it felt like to me that this person was actually saving me. And the things that he asked me to do as far as what we now how I've identified as sex trafficking, it seemed okay for me at the time. But it wasn't until later that I realized that this isn't what a love relationship should be. This isn't how a boyfriend should treat you.
And how did you first meet him?
Over the internet, which that was 16 years ago, almost 17 years ago. So now imagine how common that is and how easy it is for them, traffickers.
And I've heard you tell your story before, and you sort of explained your background in terms of being poly-traumatization. Like, you were already at particular risk for this.
Absolutely, and that's what we do see with a majority of kids that are victimized by sex trafficking, is that they have trauma already occurring in their life, whether it's physical abuse, sexual abuse, mental abuse, drug addiction, parents that have drug addiction. All of it can affect and empower a trafficker to have be able to coerce them and to gain control over them.
And over the course of the year that, you know, you were traveling between Venice and Atlanta, how many times did you go up there? Was it every weekend?
It was every other weekend for approximately a year.
And as you said, you actually looked forward to it. It was sort of escaping a not-so-pleasant home life, to put it mildly.
Yeah, he convinced me that we were going to be married, that he started calling me his fiancé. He told his family that I was 19 and introduced me to his family members. And he actually came from a very, very wealthy family. This isn't somebody that you would think of as a typical pimp or now what we call a trafficker. This was somebody that came from a fairly decent home life. It came from an abusive background, but he came from a decent home life, so it wasn't what people today would think of as trafficking.
How did it come about that he, I guess, approached you with the concept of having sex with other men?
It was, the way he phrased it to me was not that I was engaging in prostitution or anything like that. The way he had initiated it was that he thought that, he had told me that he thought that that would be enjoyable for him and for me from a sexual standpoint, in the sense of having a polyamorous relationship with other people.
But he was actually getting paid for this.
Yes, yes.
And did you know that at the time?
No, I wasn't aware of that. I should have put two and two together, because he was giving me money. But because he came from a, like I said, a well-to-do family, I never really connected it. But he was, I do know for a fact that he was advertising me online as someone to have sex with. So, and it wasn't people, he wasn't having me engage with people he knew. These people were complete strangers. So there had to have been some kind of benefit to him over this.
Well, and Jamie, I have to say, seeing you today and, you know, imagining what you would have looked like at 13 or 14 years old, I can't imagine anybody actually believing you were 19.
No, nobody did. Right. Very few people actually. Honestly, I've looked back at pictures of myself at that age, and I've shaken my head just like, oh my God, if I saw this myself, I'd freak out, because I know this person's not 19. So, there's definitely no question that all of the adults that I engaged with during the time I was trafficked, they had to have known how old I was. It's very, very common for traffickers to make up children to be more adult. That didn't happen in my case. They left me to look exactly the way I looked.
And, I mean, these people who will pay to have sex with a child, what do they look like?
They look like average people. People in this, like, you would see anywhere. Not to get too specific, but some of the people I engaged with, I engaged with somebody from the military. I engaged with two professors, one of which was a female, that were in a relationship together. They were people from pretty decent walks of life that I was engaging with, that you would think, no, this is a street walking, hotels, seedy hotels kind of thing, and no, that's not who I was being advertised to. I was being advertised to people that had money.
And did you ever come to realize on your own that you were being manipulated and coerced, or did that really only kind of come out later as you went through therapy?
It took some time during the course of the year that it happened, but I was the one that removed myself from the situation, because I was very lucky in the sense that my trafficker was in Atlanta at the time. So in order for him to get me to come back, he would have had to force me to, which would be very complicated and involve way more crimes. Because at the time, human trafficking wasn't even a federal law when this occurred to me. So, yeah.
How were you able to end the relationship? What prompted that?
As I tell a lot of people, it only takes one person really caring and talking to a child to let them know that this isn't appropriate. I had no sense that the relationship I had with him was inappropriate. because of all the abuse that I had experienced in my life prior to meeting him. So I thought it was very normal. And it wasn't until a close friend of mine, I had a discussion with him about it, and he kind of explained to me in a very non-judgmental way, this is not how somebody who's in love with you would treat you. This isn't, that's not normal. Mm-hmm. But the way I was able to stop it was to just tell him, please don't contact me anymore. I'm not going to fly to Atlanta anymore. I can't do this anymore. And he did try to manipulate me to come back, but it was from a psychological perspective. He kept telling me he loved me and that he was going to hurt himself if I didn't come back.
Did you ever consider reporting him?
I did report him, not for my case, but for a case later. I did report him to the FBI, and the only reason they were not able to do anything with that case is the girl he was engaging with. We didn't know about trafficking, but we knew she was underage, and she was in another state. And the state that she was in, I believe it was Indiana, they had a law saying that if she had children, she was considered an adult. So that's why the FBI wasn't able to do anything.
Wow, wow. Well, and tell us a bit about the organization that you've since founded, the Wayne Foundation, with filmmaker Kevin Smith. I imagine that was brought about by your own experiences, wanting to help others.
Yes, that's what we've based it around from the get-go. We started almost 7 years ago, and he was the one who approached me and said, how would you like to run a charity? And I said, well, no, because it was the economy had just collapsed. But when we got to talking about it, I thought, well, no, this is a really good way. He's got such a large audience. This is a really good way to get trafficking, the issue of trafficking, out there to people. And so people can understand what a victim really looks like, that their whatever picture they have in their head is probably inaccurate.
And the Wayne Foundation also operates in the Venice area?
Yeah, okay.
And you have a drop-in center. Tell us about what that concept is all about.
Well, a drop-in center is for, the one thing that we don't do is we don't provide long-term care, but we provide everything but. So food, we have a full kitchen, we have a shower, computers, free clothing, which are brand new, psychological services, job placement services, educational services. It's a place that can be tailored to the trafficking victim themselves. Whatever their needs are, we're there to kind of help fill that. So although we can't provide shelter, we can provide everything else that could be in their life that they might be having the need for.
Okay, and even just, you know, socialization.
Absolutely. Fun interaction, learning to just, quote-unquote, be normal and just know how to have fun, because fun is a learned trait. We're very big about having gaming systems and doing creative projects together and things of that nature.
And I wanted to turn to Lowell and Sally Senitz with Wings of Shelter International. I spoke with you guys several years ago, and I'm happy to get an update on how things are going there. But as we've listened to Jamie's story, was there any kind of streak of recognition? Do you hear similar stories from victims who end up in your care?
Yeah, actually the first three girls that we got into our program, and by the way, we are long-term rehabilitation services. They were Southwest Florida residents living at home in single-parent families. So when I heard Jamie talk, I really wanted to get the point out that these are not just kidnapped girls. These are girls that are taken from the schools. A lot of times they approach us in the school, the shopping center. And so that's, it really rang true, her story.
Do you think the issue of sex trafficking is just more pervasive than people even realize? Because I'm thinking of Jamie's story here compared to what I think of as human trafficking before I had heard her story and realizing, oh my gosh, it is happening all around me. I mean, I could have very well been sitting next to you in a high school science class and never known what was going on in your life.
Well, the story from Jamie and her experience is exactly like each little girl that we get into the safe house, and we take girls from 10 years of age through 17, and we are long-term. They can stay for, 10 minutes or 10 months or into years. They've stayed, graduated, gone on to college or a different vocation. But we get more than several dozen calls per week to take children. And what we really need out there is more trained safe houses and safe harbor homes that are long-term, because there is a revolving door syndrome. If a child is not looked at carefully and treated carefully, excuse me, she will rotate like a revolving door through group homes or placements that aren't educated to know how to respond to the high post-traumatic stress disorders that a girl has acquired.
Tell me a bit about your experience in creating the shelter. I know you went on missions in Romania, Nairobi, the Sudan, really all over. And kind of what did you learn there? And does human trafficking or sex trafficking in those countries operate the same way it does domestically here in the U.S.?
There's some overlapping similarities and some differences. We've traveled for over 30 years on behalf of oppressed children and people. And we started a safe house in Timișoara, Romania, about 17 years ago. And we learned a lot through that home. We there took in 48 children at a time because we had a four-story building. And we learned a lot about what works with these children to help them realize, like Jamie was talking about, being brainwashed in the concept that this is normalization, this is what you do to have a boyfriend. And we worked a lot there. We've worked into Sudan and helped in efforts to rescue over 200 Sudanese children out of the desert floor area, and their parents had been slaughtered in Darfur. We've worked for many years in Nairobi, Kenya, and working on intervention of child trafficking there and training a lot. So we can compare international to our national problem here. And like I say, there's a lot of similarities. It works with the same kind of lie and the attention to recruit a girl to maybe go in from the boyfriend romantic standpoint and then move into the harshness of sales. One of the things I say when we're training is if a little girl is exploited five times a day or a night, which is a very low figure, and she's exploited 5 days a week, by the time she's reached her fifth year, she would have been raped 6,500 times by men. And that's a low figure. So you can equate that to the result of that high stress disorder. And that's what we are becoming expertise in. We've only had two girls run away from Wings of Shelter in 8 years. So we can say that our program is working.
And can you speak to the broad spectrum of needs that these girls really require in order to rehabilitate? I mean, because it's not just physical, it's psychological, education. It seems quite daunting.
Well, we put our girls into private schools to start with because it's a smaller group of people. We educate the school leaders and the educators on the problem of human trafficking and prepare them to work with girls with high stress. So the answer for a girl that needs to have assistance to get out of this lifestyle is not to send her to a public school that is undereducated and overburdened with too many children. And the second thing is placement of children into safe houses. We have a precious few safe houses in the nation. We were the first safe house for long-term in the state of Florida, and that was even in 2008. So we're babies in this arena. But I think that more education is needed. One of the things we see needed sorely is clearing houses where the police or law enforcement can first bring a girl, and she's actually cleared through mental health. She is tested and evaluated for about a 30-day period. We don't have that in the state of Florida. We are just putting kids into any group home, and they're not prepared or educated for that child.
And you had mentioned earlier the need for more shelters, for more organizations that do what you do, and I am very curious about the two of you as private citizens setting up the shelter as opposed to, say, the state of Florida or the federal government.
Well, I think this is a problem that goes way beyond a governmental system. This is a human problem. And I think every one of us have to step up to the plate and see what it is in the whole aspect or realm of child trafficking or adult trafficking, what you can do to be a part of the answer. We as Americans like to lay it over onto our government. And I would say the state of Florida has done a phenomenal job of trying to come up to above the water in terms of intervention of child trafficking. But we have a long way to go, and we need all of the people out there that are listening to discover what they can do to volunteer or get involved to eradicate this fastest growing crime in the world.
All right. And I wanted to turn now to Lieutenant Ken Becker. He is supervises the Collier County Sheriff's Office's Special Crimes Unit or Bureau, correct?
Special Crimes Bureau, yes, John. Okay.
And just this month, your department announced, the conclusions of a six-month investigation netted two human traffickers and the rescue of four victims. I was hoping maybe you could tell us a bit about that case and how common that is.
Well, absolutely. This is actually our third arrest of human trafficking in the last year. We had one case which was international victims who had been smuggled into the United States, and then the other two were domestic. In this particular case, we had our detectives working, pulling intel, researching, and they actually identified these two individuals that we arrested last week. From that point, we started determining just exactly which girls they were victimizing and using. When we had the opportunity, we'd get out there and try to make contact with them, talk to them, and get them to cooperate and provide or accept the services that we were working to get them. Last week, it was a case where deputies had been dispatched to the motel that they were working out of at the time. One of the victims was actually overdosed in the bush and had requested help, and that's how we got the opportunity at that point to get involved. Once we talked to her, we were able to get her help, medical help, provide services for her, but she also told us that one of the victims had overdosed on three different occasions in the past week by these individuals, and they had heard somewhere in order to revive him to just shoot him up with saline. So obviously we had a big concern for victims inside of the hotel room. So at that point we were forced, even though we were close to being able to make an arrest on this case, we were actually forced into it. We had information that they were possibly well-armed. They had been arrested in the past with firearms, so we activated our SWAT team. We're getting ready to make entry into the hotel when they actually came out and became mobile. And at that point, we conducted a traffic stop. We're able to take those two into custody, rescue another female that was inside of the hotel at the time. But as the investigation continues, we're currently up to about 25 individuals that we have identified that have been victimized by them. And we're hoping to make contact with them and be able to provide services for them.
All right, so this is technically still ongoing, this investigation.
Yes, these are very long-term investigations, not only up to the point where you're able to make an arrest, but it's a long-term investigation and follow-up afterwards.
And in recent years, has the Collier County Sheriff's Office or perhaps other law enforcement agencies sort of changed their approach to addressing these kind of cases? And by that I'm referring to, you know, the arrest of a minor on prostitution charges as opposed to going after the traffickers.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole mindset for the sheriff's office has changed. In the past, it would be a case of doing operations to try to arrest the prostitutes and put them in jail or set up an operation and arrest the Johns. Obviously, that's just a revolving door. As soon as we get them in jail, they're quite often bonding out and back out on the streets before we even finish the paperwork. But now our philosophy is going after the pimps. They are organized crime, they're prostituting victims, and quite often they're keeping them under control by the use of illegal narcotics. So quite often when we make an arrest, we've got racketeering charges, we've got prostitution or depriving or receiving proceeds from prostitution and the possession of narcotics. In this particular case, with just the drugs that one of the individuals had on him, he's looking at a minimum mandatory of 15 years. So we get more bang for the buck, and I think we're going to be a lot more effective in combating prostitution and human trafficking.
All right. And just wanted to go back to Lowell and Sally Senate. I know in the past you've done workshops, both for the public and for law enforcement agencies. Is that something that's ongoing? And really, what are the points you try to make in those workshops?
Yeah, we actually give various trainings. We train law enforcement, we train hospitals, we train judicial, we train public, we train children. We train pretty much anywhere that we're invited. But one of the big things we do is we train others to open up safe houses. That's been a real focus of ours because there's so few beds in the United States, and there's such a great need. Like Sally was saying, well, we've had, I think, one day we got calls for 12 girls in just one day. Lately, it's been more like 12 a week, and we take girls from all over the state of Florida. Wow. And so, consequently, we are available for training if anyone wants to contact us, because it is the need is great, and it's domestic. It's not just international. When people hear about human trafficking, they think mostly international when they think about it, and that's what we did. Before we got involved, we saw an MSNBC program, and that's when we said, gee, we're traveling around the world, but it's happening here in our own backyards. So if anybody wants to give us a call and contact us, we would be open to coming and training.
All right. And how is Wings of Shelter funded? Are there state or federal funds available to you?
There probably are, but we haven't had the time to go after federal grants, and we don't have the knowledge to do so. But people, it's the hearts of people, philanthropic people that have provided income for us to become a long-term safe house and operate this many years. And so we just depend on the fact that if we together, we really can make a difference. And people have jumped in. When you hear about such a problem of this that's a horrendous nature, you want to help. And so it's the hearts of the people that have supported us.
All right. And author Michael Hirsch is with us in studio today. He wrote the book Fly Unzipped, in which his character, Fly Moscone, finds himself going undercover to collect evidence on sex traffickers through a special task force headquartered in Fort Myers. This is a work of fiction, but, I mean, is this largely based on true events?
I've been a journalist all my life. It's fiction based absolutely on fact.
And and we saw this in Jamie's case here in terms of, you know, meeting the man in Atlanta on the internet and then him advertising her on the internet. And I know that that's something that you had talked about. How is it, do you think, that, you know, websites like Backpage.com are able to have these, you know, escort advertising things when they're advertising children?
That's the one thing when I talk about my book with people and tell them what's going on and show them Backpage.com, where you can order a girl like you can order a pizza in Southwest Florida, and they go, I thought prostitution was illegal. And it just says that no matter what's going on here and with the people in this room, it just seems to me to say that we really don't care enough to stop it. We got other priorities. I was shocked when I first saw Backpage.com, and I'm still shocked when I see what's out there. I mean, you know, new girls coming this week, you know, Fort Myers, Naples, Venice, Sarasota. How can that go on? And part of the problem I learned as I was researching the book is that law enforcement really doesn't have the money to maintain these special task forces and keep them operating all the time. And it seems that that's what needs to happen.
It's interesting that these websites are able to continue doing this when we know what they're advertising.
It's, I guess, the First Amendment goes a long way.
I see. Susanna Nesmith joins us by phone. She's a reporter, and she's with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Her piece looked a lot, an in-depth look at human trafficking here, or sex trafficking here in Florida as well. And Susanna, thanks so much for being with us. I was hoping you could just kind of give us a little bit of a summary of your report and what you were looking into.
Well, thank you for having me. I was looking into how these prosecutions were going. You see the billboards, hear about the task forces and the coalitions and all of the outreach campaigns. And we've seen laws changed in Florida to make it easier to prosecute. For example, Jamie talked about the coercion. Well, in Florida now, police do not have to prove that a child was coerced into trafficking. The child could have been doing that voluntarily, and it's still illegal. They changed that law in Florida to make it easier to go after these pimps who are victimizing children. However, there are only 24 men and women in prison in Florida for sex trafficking, or the prior law, which was called human trafficking. So as much as we have talked about doing this, as much as we have tried, as many task forces and coalitions as have been put together, not a lot of these guys are going to prison. Some of them are going to prison on lesser charges that are easier to prove, or like it sounds like in the Collier County case, maybe one of those guys is going to go to prison on a drug charge. I know here in Miami, Catherine Fernandez-Rundle, the state attorney, has a task force that is also looking, okay, what other charge can we put this guy in prison for? What else is out there? In an effort to really take a broad-based look at it. But she had to drop a third of her cases, just drop them. And she had the most cases that actually sent traffickers to prison. She had 15 out of the 24. Collier County had one as well. Only one has been sent to prison for life. Orlando managed to send one to prison for life. But these cases are very difficult for police to prove. The investigations are complicated, often complicated by the fact that the victims are so traumatized. So that's what I found. It was a frustrating finding. Find an answer to how to make it better.
And you reported a disproportionately large number of Florida's convicted sex traffickers are from Miami-Dade County. Do you think that's largely a result of ramped up efforts of the state attorney's office there, or is there just simply more activity going on in Miami?
Oh, no, I think that's largely because Catherine Fernandez-Rundle has a special task force set up. There are, no question, there are sex traffickers around the state. There is an area along the I-4 corridor that is notorious, and police know about it. They know that girls are being trafficked through various counties up there, but they're very difficult to track down. It's very difficult to prove the cases against them.
And, a central character in your story, Susanna, was a notorious Miami-area sex trafficker, Alexander Valdez, who went by the nickname Daddy A+. Could you tell us just a bit about him, how extensive his trafficking ring was, and how that operation eventually was taken down?
He was a very interesting guy. You know, I interviewed him along with CBS4's Jim Defeatty in prison. He's doing 18 years. He estimated he would only do 11 of those, but I didn't really check that. He really gave us insight into how manipulative these people are. He's a very smart guy. He is not stupid. And he tried very hard during that interview to manipulate both me and Jim Defeatty. He was very quick on his feet. He came up with stories very quickly to explain all kinds of things, including the fact that he had pimpin' tattooed on his arm. But his version of pimpin' was just, he takes money from people, women, who live with him, and then he pays the bills. That's all pimpin' was to him, he claimed. Police were able to catch him because one of his victims escaped, went to police. While they were investigating that, a complete stranger, didn't know him from anybody, saw him beating a woman in his car and called 911 and then followed him for miles along the highway while he continued to beat this woman. Police caught him again. They let him go because she said, no, he wasn't beating me. Well, a couple days later, they've got a picture of her with a huge black eye. He was beating her. He was very violent. He was running a bunch of different girls. He was providing them with drugs. And it only essentially takes one to escape, to get loose, to maybe have somebody just talk to her in the same way that someone talked to Jamie and tell her, look, this is not acceptable. You don't have to put up with this. But it takes a fairly extensive investigation. The only reason they were really, I won't say the only reason, but the main reason they were able to send him to prison is he got frustrated sitting in jail waiting. And so he sent one of his buddies some letters with very detailed instructions on how to stalk his victims. Well, the cops got a hold of the letters. At that point, he had to take a plea. He was facing life, and the letters were very damning. So he dug his own grave there. But not all of them make those kinds of mistakes, and the cases are very difficult to prove.
Well, and Susanna in her piece talks about, you know, just the vast sums of money that people who run these operations are able to generate. And Nolan Tice with the Human Trafficking Awareness Partnership, I was hoping maybe you could address why people get into this business. What makes this so lucrative compared to, you know, other top illegal industries like guns or drugs?
It's a very simple answer to that question. It's a very low-risk crime to commit, and it's a very high-profit crime to commit. And so people who traffic, basically they have about a 1% chance of getting caught, and the victim has about a 0.5% chance of being recognized. Not that that victim will receive attention, but that somebody will say, yes, that person maybe was a trafficking victim. So when I listen to all of these huge problems, my brain goes to, and this is what happened with me and my efforts, because I first started out by being very concerned about bringing community members together and all the people together who have to form those task forces and do this work. And we've been successful in doing that. But as you hear from the previous speaker, we have those things, but we maybe not have the money to keep it going, and other issues come up. So what I'm trying to do, and is the at least 50% of the work we do, is to look at prevention and to look at the children who live in the communities or who have live in a high-risk situation. That doesn't necessarily mean poor children. It can mean wealthy children, middle-class children who live in houses with substance abuse or alcohol abuse or only one parent, all those other risk factors. And what we do is we go out and do programs with them, but we don't just go in one day for 1 hour and tell them about trafficking. We spend 10 hours with them in 5 sessions, and we teach them how trafficking is a huge social issue, but they can have an impact in it. And I tell them lots of stories about kids who've actually made a difference in human trafficking, but in also lots of other social change things, and how children are often the group that have to that do the work of social change. So they're the ones who, when integration came, they were the ones who were in school with each other, and they're the ones who've now become the parents who make those changes. So with human trafficking, we teach them what it is. We ask them to come up with images that they think will teach others, and they produce beautiful artwork. It's 3 feet by 4 feet, and we exhibit it all over the world. Right now, it's being exhibited in 8 different locations. 2 different locations at this moment, but in the last 6 months, 8 different locations. So the paintings are out there, and that gives them the feeling of power. And really, the children need a feeling of power to offset the powerful people who are trying to draw them in. So prevention, I think, is a crucial thing. Getting into the schools is so difficult. We can do it on and off, but what we really need to do is reach the kids where they are and provide them with information that they can use and provide them with the power that they can have to make a change in the world. Because this could be their issue.
On today's special edition of Gulf Coast Live, we're exploring the problem of sex trafficking in Florida, how to identify and help victims, and going after the traffickers. We're broadcasting before a live studio audience today, but listeners can join the conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Join our live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live, or comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. You can watch us online right now at WGCU.org/Gulf Coast Live. And we do have a caller on the phone. Alex in Fort Myers has been waiting patiently. Alex, you're on the air. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on my show. This is a very serious topic for me, as I have gone through firsthand similar experiences. For the record, I spent the past 4 years of my life trying to get out of the sex industry in the form of an exotic dancer. I do not consider myself, nor have I ever considered myself, a prostitute, but I have friends that are have been convicted prostitutes that I just know just from life and from similar agencies as you spoke of. And this is a very close topic to me because I think the movement of trafficking is misunderstood by our social culture, and that it commonly separates a problem that is very much connected. I'm calling in, and I'm going to be straight up with you. I chose to go into exotic dancing. Nobody forced me. But the same vulnerabilities, lack of opportunities, mental and physical abuse, and stigmas are faced regardless of age or entry. And I feel that a lot of the hardships that Jamie faces as far as learning how to have fun, overcoming PTSD, I faced those too. And that's from working in the club for years. And I've dedicated a lot of time escaping these clubs and understanding how to overcome this. And it's a never-ending battle for me. There's nothing like that fast money. And I feel that the culture of our society stigmatizes women who identify with sex work in the form of dancing, escorting, prostitution, in that it criminalizes us, and when sex traffic victims are the ones who are victimized. And I just want to make the point that there's a very fine line when it comes to consent, and that women face the very same vulnerabilities as who chose to be in the industry, whether it's dancing, whether it's pornography, that sex traffic victims go. 60% of these women are proven to have PTSD. And my real beef is with the Florida statute that I think propagates prostitution in this industry, because it, number one, yes, I know that there are movements and they're trying to eradicate sex trafficking through proving, these people are victims, not criminals. And even Governor Rick Scott back in 2013 passed some sort of opportunity for convicted prostitutes to appeal their charges, and is that only if they could prove that they were victimized. And I think that a lot of the problem is not only goes hand in hand with prevention and with humanity, but it goes with reform. I think that lawmakers need to go back and read the Florida statute, chapter 796.07, paragraph 6, which requires convicted prostitutes to pay $5,000 in fines to the court. And that stood out to me when I actually was incarcerated on completely different charges. I've never been charged with prostitution. But when I was incarcerated, one of my friends, really good friends, was incarcerated as a prostitute. And it was her first prostitution charge. Her name was Shayna. And I just remember sitting in jail with her and her looking at me and asking me, Alex, how am I going to pay these fines? How does the court expect me to pay $5,000 for this prostitution fine?
Well, Alex, I can definitely hear the passion in your voice there, and you've definitely done your homework, and I appreciate what you've brought to the table there. But wanted to talk a little bit and shift focus towards the prosecution of cases like this. And we're joined by Francine Donoromo, Assistant State Attorney for Florida's 20th Judicial Circuit. Can you just tell us a little bit about your involvement, perhaps in prosecuting cases like this, what we've been talking about today?
Well, for years, our office through the Special Victims Unit has been prosecuting children of sex crimes. And because the laws have only changed recently to be easier to prosecute, we've kind of focused on the individuals sexually abusing the minors. And we can get up to lifetime sentences, 25-year minimum mandatory sentences. So those are good, but they're not enough. Clearly, we needed the human trafficking statute to change, and it did. And we are now training all the special victims prosecutors how to prosecute these cases more effectively. We have all of the law enforcement agencies passionate right now about prosecuting and investigating human trafficking. It's a huge undertaking to find these organizations. So you're not focusing on one individual, but multiple victims and multiple defendants. And so it does take money and time, and they are doing a wonderful job right now. We will start seeing them prosecuted more frequently, and they are presently, and hopefully we'll see those come to light. When it comes to young adults being prosecuted and victimizing young adults, it's done usually through drugs and prostitution. So the statute has helped us, saying that coercion can be defined in the form of providing these victims with Schedule I and Schedule II drugs for the purposes of exploitation. So that manipulation through drugs as well has now been written into the statute, so that helps, as well as keeping people's passports and identifying information if they're brought from out of the country. So it is changing, it's evolving, and we have a lot to work with, but we also work, there's the federal government that works on these cases as well, and the statewide office as well, because it crosses counties frequently.
And the state law that went into effect in 2012, making it easier to prosecute these cases, how exactly does it do that?
Well, it gives us more definitions and more versions of coercion. It increases the sentences. It's a first-degree felony. And we can charge multiple counts for multiple violations of the statute. And we do look for other charges in addition to human trafficking. So we will look to sexual battery. We will look to drug trafficking, so we can get our minimum mandatory sentences. I don't see anything wrong with somebody getting in prison for 25 years, regardless of the charge. But focusing on the victim is very important. So all of these agencies getting together, it doesn't always seem like we produce a lot, but it does, because they're the ones that work with the victims. They have to participate in the prosecution, and that's very, very difficult.
And you know, are cases of sex trafficking present? Are they common now, more so than they used to be, because these rules have made it, I guess, easier to prosecute?
Not yet.
Not yet.
It's getting there. We still do, of course, all the individual cases. We have a huge caseload of children being victimized sexually. We do not have a huge human trafficking caseload. It is getting there as the investigations get more and more involved.
Are cases easier to prosecute? And I'm getting this from the comments you said earlier. Just want to clarify, when there has been, I guess, an operation involving, you know, multiple people and multiple victims, as opposed to, you know, cases like Jamie's, where as far as we know, there weren't other girls involved. That seems like her case would be much more difficult to prosecute.
It depends, actually, on the individual case. If the victim is able and in a right state of mind, I mean, they are trauma victims. If they're able to participate in the prosecution, we have a limited period of time to bring it to trial. If they're able, single victims are just as easy to prosecute as multiple victims. The advantage of cases where we're able to identify multiple victims is that we have more witnesses to convince a jury, but we have to coordinate them.
Yeah. I would imagine that, you know, victims who are still defending their abusers are, well, really like a defender's dream, but terrible for you.
Well, this is why services are important. When you have post-traumatic stress, you have to go through counseling. You have to go through rehab most of the time. Most of the situations I see with young adult victims is that they are addicted to heroin or crack cocaine. So they have many layers of things that they have to work through, and we have to focus on their needs as well as the prosecution.
All right. On today's special edition of Gulf Coast Live, we're exploring the problem of sex trafficking in Florida, how to identify and help victims, and going after the traffickers. We're broadcasting before a live studio audience today, but listeners can join the conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Join our live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live, or comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. We're also video streaming today's program. You can watch online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live, and then just click on the Homegrown Girls link right at the top of the page. You know, one of the things we talked about is prevention, but then also identifying victims. There's this new law that's taken effect this year requiring massage parlors, adult entertainment venues, highway rest stops, airports, to post these posters urging people to look for signs. Nola Tice, again, I was hoping maybe we could jump to you to sort of talk about what some of the signs are that we would be looking for in these victims.
Well, it depends on the location. It's very important. Even in hotels, we do trainings that are specifically for the housekeeping staff, which is different than the front desk staff, which is different than the management. So it's very specialized. And certainly in the transportation hubs, there's differences. So, you know, what we need to do is recognize that one sign is not going to be the answer for everything. When we started working with Lee Memorial, we had a list of signs and a protocol, and then we stopped and with them, and we worked on the appropriate way to report. So recognizing the signs, but training people also to know what's appropriate for them to do in terms of how to treat the person that they may think is a victim, which is basically most cases not to treat them, but instead to get the information and get the information to people who know what to do. So I would love to say that these are the signs, and there have been hundreds of cards that say these are the signs, but it really has to fit into the specific situation. Just yesterday, we spoke to a person in a jewelry store who said she sees men come in with girls who will not look up, who will not do anything except what they're told to do in terms of picking out jewelry. That is not a normal reaction. But the lady who told us that said she sees it all the time. She had no idea what to do with that information. So that's why there seem to be multiple groups that are doing outreach, and that's great because we can all reach different places and we all have different points of view. But typical signs are branding or tattoos. When I first started working at this 10 years ago, we talked about tattoos, and they were always undercover, and now they're on people's necks, and they may be barcodes. They may be overt signs that show that person's considered an object to be sold. That's one of the first things. Not being able to make eye contact, not knowing where they live. I mean, if you encountered a child in an emergency room and they didn't know what city they were in, those are signs that they may be being transported. And certainly being controlled by the accompanying adult is one of the major signs.
All right. And I wanted to jump to Jonathan Smith here. He's a child protective investigator with Florida's Department of Children and Families. Is this something you come across in your work?
I haven't been doing this for very long, but the person sitting next to me has, and she's addressed that this is a common occurrence, and it is under my skin. Like, I can't even shake it, and I've got daughters, and I just can't even fathom this happening to my daughter. So my fiance works here, and she asked me to come, and this is an unbelievable situation. This thing, it's getting under my skin. So,
all right. Well, let's hear from Ethan. I'm sorry, I can't see the name tag there. I apologize.
Sylvia Guerrero.
Sylvia.
Yes.
Tell us about your involvement in the issue.
As an educator, I'm actually fascinated by this. I've worked in the K-12 district for a while, and now I'm here at the university level. And my issue was what can be done to educate us educators. We're in the front lines. We see these children day in and day out. A lot like Jamie's story, some of these children are living normal daily lives. They're coming to school every day, and then then they're being exploited on their own time. So how can we as educators identify those students so that we can throw up the red flags, so that we can get to them? I know that a lot of times we can build a very trusting relationship with our students as educators, that if we knew the right things to say, if we knew the right things to look for, we might actually be able to influence these children on a much deeper level to understand, but I'm concerned that there's not enough training being done. I didn't know that much about it myself, and even as a teacher in the district, I knew more about teaching diverse populations than I did about teaching the possible victim, and that's something that I'm very passionate about also, and would love to know from Ms. Heiss, like what can educators equip themselves with?
who to contact when you see the signs. That's almost number one, because if you see signs and you report it and it goes nowhere or it goes to the wrong place, that's going to be more damaging almost than leaving the child alone, which it seems like a crazy thing to say, but it's true. But I think the signs tend to be tardiness, truancy. Those are two big signs. Inability to do homework. Seemingly afraid of teachers or other authority figures, because kids get told that their parents are not their friends, their neighbors are not their friends, their friends are not their friends. That's one of the first messages that a victim gets. So it's if they're hard to approach. But unless you're a trained social worker, specifically trained in human trafficking, you really need to get that child identified to the person who knows how to deal with it.
Meaning at the schools,
yes,
for the children, you know, like a
we
to,
do
to help them understand, because like Jamie said, she didn't realize that this was
right.
wrong until it was too late.
We do, but we have to get invited by teachers or administrators, and it's just very difficult to do. They're so afraid of words being used that shouldn't be used. And I mean, I'm afraid of kids being victimized, and they're afraid of, you know, stepping over a bound. And to me, we really have to get together and figure it out. School resource teacher officers, all those other people have the training, but they're not always the ones who see the kids on a daily basis. Watching for those changes
exactly.
is so crucial. So something minor might be really major.
I felt like I've seen some of the signs in
yeah.
my previous classes
yeah.
That I didn't know until just now what they were.
Wow, well, glad I was able to connect the two of you here. We have come up on the end of the hour, though, so we'll have to leave it there. But thanks to everyone who joined our live studio audience for today's important discussion, for sharing your insights, and for the important work you do on behalf of trafficking victims. There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers, Richard Chinqui, Amy Tardiff, Sherry Coleman, and all the members of the WGCU Public Media team who helped make today's special edition of the program happen. This is WGCU Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Markle Island, 91.7 FM, and PR for Southwest Florida.